Hi, and welcome to our second episode of Evergreencast, where we'll be discussing the opportunities of sustainable forestry. This episode comes in partnership with Scottish Woodlands and Tillhill. I'm joined today by David McCulloch from Carbon Store and Simon Oldham from Scottish Woodlands. I thought we'd dive in by just sort of giving you each a couple of minutes to kind of introduce yourselves and maybe tell us a bit about your work. So, David, I'll come over to you first.
Yeah, good morning, Heather. Thanks very much. And so I head up Carbon Store, and Carbon Store is the woodland carbon division of Tillhill. Tillhill is the leading forestry management company operating right across the UK. We have offices stretching from Uffcombe down in Devon up to Inverness in the north of Scotland. We are part of a much wider forestry products group. So we're actually owned by BSW Timber, which is the largest sawmilling group in the UK. And our sister company is Mailer Forestry Nurseries. So we've basically got everything wrapped up in one, in the sense that Mailer Forestry Nurseries grows the young trees, Tillhill plants and manages them, Carbon Store helps the woodland owners access and secure the carbon funding from their woodland creation efforts. And then eventually, once the trees are harvested and mature, and it's BSW that then processes the harvested trees, ready for delivery to construction sites and offices and gardens across the UK.
Sounds like quite the ecosystem you've got going on there. And Simon, what about yourself?
Hello, Heather. Hello, David. I'm Simon Oldham. My job is Technical Director with Scottish Woodlands Limited. Scottish Woodlands is an all-service forestry management company. We originated from a woodland owners cooperative that was established back in the 1960s and is now developed into an employee-owned company providing woodland services essentially throughout the UK. And employ somewhere in the region of 240 staff to provide that service. In rather like Tillhill, we provide key forestry management services and timber, including timber harvesting and timber harvesting marketing and woodland management. We do quite a lot in the utility contracting space as well, and manage green space on housing developments in the central belt of Scotland as well. And quite heavily involved in forestry investment area. Yeah, so that's a bit about Scottish Woodlands anyway.
Well, it certainly seemed you're both the experts to speak to on this then. So, David, I believe your work is quite focused on sort of the woodland creation activities, and perhaps you could tell us a bit about the opportunities of that.
Yeah, so, I mean, the introduction, the launch of the Woodland Carbon Code back in 2011 was a really interesting opportunity for woodland creation. And as we all know, we've got these pretty ambitious targets to be planting 30,000 hectares per year. The target dates keep changing, but essentially we need to be planting 30,000 hectares per year from 2025 out to 2050. And that will increase our woodland cover across the UK from about 13% at the moment up to 17 or 18% by 2050. And there is a key challenge in terms of woodland creation. And you look at the structure of the economics, whereby if you're a farmer contemplating the converting some farmland into woodland, you've basically got some large upfront capital costs you've got to spend in order to get the trees in the ground and put some fencing around the planting area. You've also got to forego the income that you were earning from grazing livestock on that land. And then you've actually got to wait a very long time. I mean, at least 35, 40 years, possibly longer in the case of some broadleaf schemes, before you start realising some income. And so the introduction of carbon funding helps bridge that financial gap, because the way the Woodland Carbon Code, which is the carbon standard governing woodland creation schemes in the UK, the way that is structured is it enables woodland owners to sell forward effectively their carbon credits before the carbon has actually been captured. They're essentially selling promises to capture carbon as the trees grow. And so that means that they can be earning an income from their woodlands theoretically immediately after planting. In practice, it's probably sensible to wait until the trees are a little bit more established, until you're a little bit more confident in your promises that you're making when you're selling some carbon. So perhaps you wait 5-10 years until you actually sell the carbon credits, but essentially you're able to access a meaningful income stream before the trees are actually mature and ready for harvesting. So it's transformed the economics of woodland creation.
But the challenge, David, isn't it, is the rules that go with Woodland Carbon Code now, I think, because as David describes, what should be a bridge in financing has now been transformed a little bit by the rules around additionality, which is basically a financial test to check whether woodland carbon money is necessary for planting that woodland in the first place. And wherever the scheme rules decide that that money isn't required because there's a future timber income that can be relied upon, then the woodland carbon money isn't available. So and the balance and the detail of that equation is quite a challenge for us at the moment. And I think probably, I don't know your thoughts, David, but fair to say that's still work in progress in terms of where that balance needs to be set.
Yeah, Simon, I mean, we, Scottish Woodlands and Till Hill, are completely on the same page with this one. And it is really disappointing that in upland areas, in parts of rural and remote areas of Scotland, we're not able to plant more than perhaps 30-35% of these areas with productive conifers and also secure carbon funding. And in terms of sort of harnessing the power of carbon funding in order to incentivize sort of the right tree in the right place, it's actually been a disappointing initial step. But as you say, it's work in progress, and discussions are ongoing on that front.
I think it's important to say the Woodland Carbon Code is a very necessary vehicle for the whole development of carbon forestry, because investors that want to purchase carbon units need to have some independently verified scheme which basically puts a stamp on the product that they can invest in and sell to their clients further down the line to confirm that what they're investing is achieving verifiable results in terms of carbon capture. So it's a very important vehicle, but the detail in the calculations is equally critical for getting enough development of forestry. That's what we're talking about, really, isn't it? It's trying to reach that 30,000 hectares per year, and we're a long, long way off that at the moment. I mean, the season, planting season just passed. We've planted something in the region of 12,000 hectares, I think, over the whole of the UK. That sits a long way off where we need to be.
It sounds like a difficult balance to reach. And, we've touched a little bit on sort of the opportunities of carbon storage, but I wondered, Simon, could you perhaps tell us a bit more about timber production and the incentive for that?
Sure, yeah. Well, as David described, I mean, a lot of commercial forestry investment in the UK, and I say that quite loosely. It's a fairly broad, that covers a fairly broad church, really, from small farmers who will plant for commercial reasons, but will combine those objectives with objectives to shelter their livestock, to shelter watercourses or provide shade for watercourses, to restructure their land holdings, right through traditional estates and then large-scale forestry investors. So there's a whole range of scales and approaches to what I would call commercial forestry investment. But generally, they're looking to achieve some sort of return from the sale of timber ultimately. And they've got choices along the way as to which species get planted and the way the trees are grown in terms of meeting those objectives. But I think in our discussions around climate change mitigation and carbon fixing, it's one thing to talk about the carbon fixing that trees do while they're alive, and that's really what Woodland Carbon Code is all about measuring. But the other aspect that's very important is the production of a sustainable raw material, which timber is, and Woodland Carbon Code doesn't really consider that in the same way. But essentially, timber is a very sustainable, well, fixes carbon during its lifetime. But then if that timber is put into permanent use in buildings or for long-term use, if we call it that, then that carbon is fixed in the environment. And we need much more sustainable raw materials to displace carbon-intensive raw materials as we go forward. So, in the built environment situation, there's a lot of pressure to increase the use of timber for building, because timber buildings are typically 60 to 70% smaller, lower carbon footprint than equivalent buildings made out of steel and concrete. And producing a ton of steel releases about 1.2 tons of CO2. Producing the same ton of concrete releases about 200 kilos of CO2, whereas growing a ton of timber will absorb about a ton of CO2, absorb it. So there's a fundamental difference in the production of those raw materials, and the more we can do with timber, the better. But we're seeing a situation at the moment around the world where timber demand is increasing, particularly in the developing countries. As they develop, they want more timber and the timber products that come with that. In the UK, we import 80% of the timber we use, because we have a very low production of timber in the UK for historic reasons, and that makes us the second largest importer of timber and wood products in the world after China, which is quite an amazing statistic, I always think. But that growth in demand for timber is very important, and we're seeing at the moment that a lot of the places we rely on to import that timber are struggling to keep growing sustainable timber for us. I mean, we're watching in the news at the moment parts of the world where the forests are burning. That's a big problem, and as climate change changes, we will see plant health issues abroad as well as wildfire issues abroad increasingly that threaten forest resources. And for the UK to rely on importing that material is really not a sustainable position for us. I mean, this year alone, I think in Chile, there's been about 480,000 hectares of forestry lost to wildfire. Now, we don't hear a lot about things like that, but that's a huge area of productive forestry that's lost. Now, we don't import from Chile particularly, but the countries that do import from Chile will be looking to the Scandinavian countries that we do import from to secure their raw materials. So we're in a very much a global supply situation that is threatened a bit by climate change, and we need to be a bit more strategically minded about where that timber comes from.
Yeah, I mean, Simon, just to echo that, I mean, and the whole debate at the moment is optimizing our land use given the new world of natural capital and the opportunities presented by sustainable, productive forestry, particularly across sort of upland areas of Scotland, are really significant. And so by not harnessing those opportunities and by importing those wood materials from, you know, Scandinavia or elsewhere, we're literally giving jobs away to other countries, jobs and economic activity that could be, you know, really valuable for sustaining economically and environmentally, come on to that in a moment, rural communities. The other point is to put into context the value of those harvested wood products that you've just been talking about, Simon, from an environmental perspective. And I mean, sort of afforestation, according to the Committee for Climate Change, afforestation is really going to do the bulk of the heavy lifting in terms of the reduction in emissions from our land use over the next 30 years by 2050. And if we're undertaking agroforestry and we're meeting our planting targets, that's going to take, according to the Committee on Climate Change, it's going to achieve about 55% of our emissions reduction targets from land use, and that totals about 20 million tons. Once you consider the volume of carbon that's locked up in the built environment, you add another 14 million tons of carbon capture into that figure. So it potentially has a really significant impact. If we can really harness, you know, the use of timber frame buildings in particularly in England, you know, cross-laminated timber, the opportunities presented by that. You mentioned it in the previous podcast. It's really significant and really valuable, both economically and environmentally as well.
I mean, it sounds like when you put it like that, the growth of the domestic market is just a bit of a no-brainer, really. But how can we make sure that everyone is kind of on that same page and working towards the same goals?
I think it's a big challenge, Heather. And we're a small island nation with a large population, and that probably means we have a lot of conflicting demands on the land that we have. I think we've got a historic legacy to deal with as well in terms of land use, in that we have a history that involved depletion of our forestry resource over a long period of time when we were busy fighting wars around the world, taking on everybody in that sense, and also industrializing heavily. So we needed timber to fight battles in the past, and we felled a lot of our woodlands for that. We then needed timber to do coal mining, to create for pit props, to go mining for coal in the UK. And there was a lot of forestry area felled to produce pit props for that industrial revolution. And all of that gradually depleted our forestry resource over a long period of time, to the extent where I think at our lowest point, the UK had about 5% forest cover back in the early 1900s, when the Forestry Commission was formed with a strategic aim to replenish that forest resource. And gradually, we've been very slowly recovering from that position to where we are now, where we're roughly about 13% forest cover across the UK. But that still compares with an average across Europe at about 41% of land cover. So with that history of land use, we've got a bit of a legacy issue to deal with in terms of public perception. We've got a very strong agricultural industry that's developed on that land. I think it's fair to say that in a lot of situations where market forces push agriculture to be ever more efficient and productive, clearly they need to be fairly single-minded about how they manage that land. And converting land to forestry often feels like a loss of productive capacity from them as a food producer. So I think we've got a lot of these issues to work out. I think there is room for all sectors. There are a lot of different land use requirements. There's a lot of habitat and biodiversity requirement demands on land as well as public recreation demands increasingly on our lands and forests. So all of these demands have to have their place, and it's a question of seeing the broader picture and the importance of not only sustainable food production, but also sustainable timber production and cellulose production. So.
And it sounds like some of those points might sort of overlap. You know, it's not necessarily that the land has to be divided between all these sectors. I mean, biodiversity is sort of, you know, being out in nature, that's known for its well-being benefits, and there's nothing to say that you can't be growing food at the same time. So yeah, it is an interesting one.
I mean, trees are great for that, because they allow us to do so many things at the same time, and I think as a land use as a land use sector, I think we're fairly unique in that, or one of the most effective in terms of being able to multitask, if you like. So we can be producing timber, we can be fixing large volumes of carbon. At the same time, we can be mitigating flood risks, we can be shading watercourses, we can be sheltering livestock, we can be providing habitat for wildlife and locations for recreational use. And all of these land uses can overlap very substantially. And a lot of that's down to careful management and design of the forests that we plant.
And actually, I mean, going back to, you know, sort of the original sort of part of the question, Heather, and looking at, you know, what are the challenges we face? And I do think sort of, you know, it's understandable that we have been managing the land in a certain way. I mean, really, for the last, I mean, post-Second World War, you know, we've seen land management in a very sort of narrow perspective in terms of maximizing food production. And what that's led to is we're not optimizing the use of the land in the new context of maximizing our carbon capture, maximizing our food production, and also enhancing our biodiversity. And so there are large parts of you know, particular, well, upland areas in Scotland, England and Wales, which we could be using more efficiently. I mean, sort of, we've got, I think, about 5 million hectares of land across the UK, which are rough grazing. Now, even if we're only sort of planting up 20% of that over the next 30 years, we're achieving our planting targets. But going back to the challenges, you know, I have a lot of sympathy with a farmer in upland areas of Scotland. Sheep farming is in his blood. It's all he's ever done. And suddenly sort of presenting him with the challenge of, oh, you've got to plant trees, is a significant hurdle to cross. And so, you know, encouraging him from a financial point of view is a start, but also from a, showing him, you know, that it doesn't have to be one or other. It's a blend of the two. That is going to be one part of the solution. There's many other challenges, but that's a key element, I guess.
And I think yeah, it's a very good point, David. Because I think that is a barrier for us as an industry to be able to reach the target planting that we're trying to achieve as a country. But it relates again to that history and the traditions of land use. And what's interesting and what I always find fascinating is when you look at other parts of the world, and in this country, as David describes, that decision to diversify and plant new areas of what is, from their point of view, a productive food-producing land, and plant it with trees is quite a challenging concept for many. But if you go to Scandinavian countries where they have had a woodland culture for centuries and haven't lost that in the way that we have, it's the farmers that make those same decisions to plant their land with trees, and they will typically manage their forestry in the winter, and then they'll manage their farmland in other parts of the year, and they achieve a sustainable land use pattern based on that tradition. And we've lost that tradition. I think that's what we have to understand and accept, that it will take quite a long time to recover that tradition of woodland, the use of woodland, productive use of woodland. I mean, the other thing probably I would say is is we have a big opportunity to capitalize on the resource we already have in terms of woodland. A lot of the benefits we talk about for multitasking with woodland ownership come with careful management of that forestry, and that includes particularly timber production. If a woodland isn't managed, it tends not to produce income. It's not going to produce timber that we can use as a raw material. But at the moment, we have something like 45% of the broadleaf woodland in the UK is just not managed. We've got a huge resource there that is effectively left and unmanaged because either it's considered uneconomic or there aren't the traditions and skills of being able to manage that resource. And there's a big opportunity for us in use of that land use, I think, as well, alongside the development of new woodland areas on farmland.
It's interesting that you've both sort of touched on history. I suppose I've never really looked at it like that. It seems that, you know, a lot of that sort of history and tradition is in perhaps, you know, the industries that have been particularly big in the UK. It would be interesting to hear your perspectives on how we can get sort of the private sector involved in the support of woodland creation and all that can come with sustainable forestry.
Yeah. That presents a significant opportunity, but also we need to be sort of conscious that the local residents in the countryside are included as part of those development plans. And I guess, I mean, sort of, it's quite interesting listening to your last podcast episode, Heather, and you started by saying, well, what is a sustainable woodland? And, you know, it's got to be sustainable economically, it's got to be sustainable environmentally, it's got to be sustainable socially, and it's got to be sustainable ecologically. Now, not all woodlands can achieve all of that at once, and so we sort of get a range of uses emerging. But coming back to Simon's point a moment ago, and looking at this woodland culture and starting to encourage people to really make the most of woodlands. You know, you look at the Forest of Ay just down the road from me here in Dumfries and Galloway. And, you know, every weekend they've got mountain biking events going on. You look at sort of Alice Holt down in Surrey outside Guildford, and the range of activities, the number of visitors, and the health and well-being opportunities. So bringing in sort of private capital. You support the funding of woodland creation and you make it sort of worth farmers' while by selling those carbon credits to corporates who are looking to achieve net zero. But they're not just looking to achieve net zero, they're also looking to provide tangible benefits to the countryside at the same time. And so if we can match those two goals up, we can improve the access to our woodlands across the countryside. We can, you know, for those companies who are operating directly in the timber or construction industries, we can allow them to support the creation of productive conifer woodlands. For companies who want to focus on the ecological elements of woodlands, they can touch on those. So we can use private funding to support the types of woodlands that the inherent characteristics of companies sort of already match up with. I hope that makes sense. And there's no doubt that creates challenges. You know, you increase access across the countryside, and we want people to be conscious of the litter that they leave, the risk to forest fires if they're camping and they're having campfires late at night, particularly in you know, the heat wave we had back in May and June. You know, there's risks like that that we need to manage if we're going to encourage people to make the most of our woodlands, but fundamentally provides a really significant opportunity.
Yes, and I think it is that that capital, the availability of capital is one of the success stories really at the moment, and certainly in UK forestry, is the demand for investment interest in forestry. We saw that scale up even a further few degrees in during the whole COVID pandemic. And I suppose since 2008, really, there's been a very strongly developing profile of investment interest in UK forestry, largely around the financial rewards associated with growing timber, but also around the tangible resource that presents, but also the sustainability aspects and environmental social aspects of that investment, which is increasingly important for most investors of all scales. So the availability of capital to invest is unprecedented in UK forestry history anyway. But we need to channel that, and we need to make sure it's creating the right types of forest resource and that it's being harnessed properly to meet the climate change objectives, the ambitious climate change objectives that we've set ourselves.
I suppose that kind of leads us into, you know, like, yes, there might be the incentives and the corporate sector might be sort of motivated to provide support, the support might be available. But at some point, I suppose they need to have that assurance that, you know, what they are doing is recognized for what it is and that everyone's kind of following the same rules and standards. And I imagine that's sort of where the Woodland Carbon Code kicks in. But I mean, how can we sort of refine that to make sure that everyone's following the same rules, as it were?
I mean, actually, Heather, that it comes back to a point that Simon made right at the beginning of the podcast in terms of the importance of the Woodland Carbon Code. You know, you're selling a credit and they've got to have credibility. So you've got to have the people who are buying them. The inherent value of those credits relies on the fact that it genuinely represents one ton of carbon that adheres to those sort of six core principles of carbon offsetting. They're real, they're additional, they're unique, they are verified. And so the Woodland Carbon Code plays a really valuable part in making sure that approved and authorized woodlands are all operating under the same rules and regulations. They're calculating their carbon capture on the same basis. They are measuring the carbon capture in the same way. They're managing their woodlands, and they're all subject to the same overriding rules and regulations.
Well, I can maybe add into that, David. I think in terms of ensuring that forestry investment is well aligned and doing the same things in the same ways and following the rules, as you called it, Heather, I think think we as an industry, we are incredibly regulated, I think, as a land use sector, and the UK forestry standard is the benchmark to which really all UK forestry is managed. Particularly, anything that wants to pursue grant funds has to manage woodland and plant woodland in accordance with the UK forestry standard. So any managed woodland areas have to comply with that as a set of basic rules, which take into account environmental requirements as well as social and economic requirements as well. So, and in addition to that, many woodlands are managed through one of the independently audited certification schemes. And we're unique in the world, really, at having a common standard that unites some of the commercially available third-party timber certification schemes. So in the UK, we have woodlands managed to the Forest Stewardship Council standards and the PEFC standard as well, both of which combined to or use the UK Woodland Assurance System, UCWAS 2, as a common standard that they've been prepared to sign up to as a sustainable model of forest management. So from that point of view, we've got a very well-structured setup to introduce more forestry investment into the UK with confidence that it doesn't repeat some of the, I think what it's fair to say, were perhaps mistakes in the past where forestry started to develop in less sustainable ways and was planting the wrong species in the wrong sites. And I'm talking about forestry going back to the 1980s here, really. And forestry's been on a long and hard journey since then to develop that sort of regulation and change the profile of and standards of forest management that apply in the UK to ensure species diversity, to ensure considerance of social and environmental factors carefully alongside the objectives to produce timber.
I was just going to follow up on that and say I've been really struck by the way that those investment funds you're talking about a moment ago, Simon, have really started to sort of take wider considerations in when they're designing and consulting on their planting work. You know, sort of they're really working closely with local communities in Scotland or Wales to make sure that they've got areas to exercise, to walk their dogs there. You know, it's not single species monoculture plantations by any stretch of the imagination. They're really sort of, you're getting an abundance of wildlife and you're getting a timber resource. So they're bringing jobs and economic activity to those local communities. So it's you know, sort of woodlands of the modern day are serving many, many more purposes than 40 years ago.
It does all sound quite complicated to navigate, but I suppose if everyone's kind of got the right incentives and with those standards to ensure that everyone's aligned on the same path, then there really are a lot of opportunities for land use to be maximized and for government goals to be reached while also serving the needs of corporations and communities. And that seems quite an optimistic outlook to end on, and I think we're just about out of time, so I will finish up there. And thank you both for joining, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in.